101.
This week on the Recording Library of West Texas Radio's Saturday Night Movie, we celebrate this weekend's big game with George Clooney's football film, Leatherheads.
For a special breed of men called Leatherheads, the rules were simple. There were no rules. But when the game they love was going under, Dodge Conley had the plan.
It's your intention to legitimize professional football?
You ever hear of Carter Rutherford, the Bullet?
War hero, football boy?
So you're a sports writer.
Why not?
Now, two of football's biggest stars will find themselves competing over the one woman.
You're the kind of cocktail that comes on like sugar but gives you a kick in the head.
Who can throw them for a loss.
Too bad we know each other so well, we might have gotten along.
Well, I'll live.
Alone.
These are a lot like your plays, only a little more effective.
George Clooney, Renee Zellweger, and John Krasinski star in the audio-described Leatherheads, Saturday night at 7 on Recording Library of West Texas Radio.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 65 and clear. Tonight, it will be cloudy with a low in the low 60s. Then, tomorrow, clear with a high in the upper 60s. Tomorrow night, mostly cloudy with a low in the mid-40s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
Welcome to the Western Magazine Hour. Stories and articles about the American West. Produced at the Recording Library of West Texas. Your narrator is Jack.
Hi, this is Jack. Here are some articles from the February-March issue of Cowboys and Indians magazine. Editor's note. Home is where the stuff is, by Hunter Hawk. Let's face it, our worlds and priorities are different from what they were this time last year, and our personal spaces have never mattered more. That's one of the reasons why we're introducing a new home and ranch section, expanding our shelter coverage with a lot of inspiring ideas. Contributing writer Rhonda Reinhart brings a wealth of experience to her mission to cover the best in the American West, and we're excited to bring you her curation of trends, interiors, and makers. I know a thing or two about rethinking a living space. I've moved 3 times in the last 18 months. A lengthier commute, a tornado, and most recently, a worldwide pandemic have spurred these relocation decisions. I'm settled now, thank goodness, and I'm also a newly minted expert on fitting my stuff into any set of rooms. My decorating approach trends to drive the completist in my family nuts. I will idle for months at a time with nothing on the main living room wall just because it's so dang difficult to commit. Yet, when the perfect piece finally reveals itself at a store, online, or even a flea market, I always find the result to be worth the wait, until I get sick of it and rearrange everything again. My latest living room is filled with the stuff that, as the newly fashionable tidy minimalists would put it, sparks joy. Certain items have been with me as long as I can remember. A table my mom and I painted and stained one summer after a trip to the flea market Mecca of Canton, Texas. A Peter Stevens portrait of Will Rogers tipping his hat at a train station. Is he saying hello or goodbye? It changes every time the door opens. A framed certificate that declares me a permanent member of the annual Hawk Family Christmas Day Gathering. Knickknacks, wooden furniture, briar horses, and succulent plants, all of it creates an emotional network of memories and important symbols. The story my living room tells might only make perfect sense to me, but I continually try to make it look nice so that visitors feel at home too. What does your favorite room say about you? What has survived every move you've ever made, and why? I'd love to know and would be glad to receive the stories behind your favorite space at a letters@cowboysandindians.com. Maybe one of your favorite things in your place is a certain photograph. an extraordinary image or a meaningful snapshot can really elevate and personalize a room. Whenever our annual reader photo contest rolls around, it strikes me anew how much a great shot can simultaneously capture deep emotion, lived experience, and unforgettable character in a single frame. You have only to look at those contest submissions or the photographs by the fine art photographers we've profiled in this issue, or even your own iPhone, to be reminded of something Dorothea Lange said: "The camera is an instrument that teaches people how to see without a camera." Jared Padalecki. Stepping into the boots of an iconic character for a new TV reimagining, the Texan star aims to retain Lone Star authenticity while exploring more modern-day subject matter. By Joe Layden. Photography by Mike DeVello. There's a new sheriff in town, or, to be more precise, a revised version of a familiar Texas Ranger. Walker, the new CW series starring Jared Padalecki, is, yes, you guessed it, a reboot of Walker, Texas Ranger, the action-adventure drama that ran for 8 seasons, 1993 to 2001, on CBS, with Chuck Norris in the title role of a Lone Star State lawman who spoke softly and carried a big kick. But be forewarned, there is a pronounced lack of martial artistry in this version. As Padalecki recently explained during a rare day off from his hectic shooting schedule in Austin, my Walker, the Cordell Walker that I play, has nothing in common with Chuck Norris's Walker, other than the name. And so our show is a reimagining more than a remake, and it's very timely. It exists in our current moments and in our current state of political dichotomy and awareness of racial inequality. And it has a socially conscious way of asking, hey, is everything working the way it should be? From the top down and from the bottom up. And so, while we're similar in name, I suppose this rose smells in a completely different way. Then, laughing at his Romeo and Juliet allusion, he added, just trying to sneak in some Shakespeare there. But did Padalecki hesitate while deciding whether to be on or not be Walker? After all, he has some mighty big boots to fill in this reboot. There was no hesitation at all, Padalecki responded. I'm a proud Texan, born in San Antonio. And while I was growing up, I would actually see Texas Rangers now and then. And I always thought they looked so cool when I'd see them in their white Stetsons at a pizza place or whatever while they were on their lunch break. And now I'm thinking, wow, I get to portray that. Better still, in Padalecki's view, the new Walker is set in Austin, where he has resided for more than a decade. So making a show about Texas, that's a source of great pride for me, he said. I'm trying to do right by the original show, but I'm also trying to do right by our wonderful law enforcement figures who continuously risk their lives and their health and happiness and that of their family and friends to try and make this place a safer place. It's a lot to take on, but it's an honor. It definitely comes with responsibility, but it's a great honor. It's also a dramatic change of pace from Supernatural, the weirder-than-life TV drama that for 15 seasons provided gainful employment for Padalecki and co-star Jensen Ackles, as they portrayed Sam and Dean Winchester, brothers who battled demons, ghosts, and assorted other paranormal pests. Because of production delays caused by the COVID-19 pandemic, the final episode of that cult fave series didn't air until November 19th, just as Padalecki was revving up Walker for a planned January premiere. To make that date, he says, most of his waking hours have been a warp speed blur of roping and riding. His Cordell Walker owns a horse ranch with his family and protecting and serving. But, mind you, he's not complaining. When the day's work is done and on his days off, he can spend quality time with his wife, Genevieve Cortese, and their three children, two boys and one girl, ranging in age from 3 to 8, at their home near Austin. That's where we caught up with the 38-year-old TV star and devoted family man. Cowboys and Indians, do your children have any idea yet what Daddy does for a living? Jared Padalecki. You know what? That's a really funny question. There'll be times when Genevieve and I have to get some work done, and so we'll stick them in front of the YouTube video or something, and then suggestions come up on screen. And so they've seen that I've been in different things, but I'm sure they've seen different scenes that I've done that I would probably rather not have them see at their age. So we decided to kind of go ahead and show them a little bit of what happens and tell them, hey, it's scary, but it's fake. Like, here's Dad. He's in a fight. But you have to remember that Dad, he has professional people that put fake blood on him, just like we do at Halloween. Funnily enough, we talked about this just yesterday, and my wife and I told them, this is just pretend. No one's in danger. No one's hurting each other. We're just pretending, just like when we're playing chase and I growl at you and you run away. And so they kind of have an idea of what I do. I think they're a little bit too young to understand exactly what's going on, but they know that Daddy goes to work and plays pretend. Along those same lines, I remember once I shot this scene for Supernatural where my character had been kind of beat up. And I had a black eye and had blood on my lip and blood coming out of my nose. Well, I got a FaceTime call from home while we were shooting in Vancouver, so I just picked it up thinking it was my wife. But it was one of my kids on the phone. And the first thing they see is Dad looking all beat up. And I had to kind of go, hey, buddy, this isn't real. And they were like, well, I don't want to see you with blood. So I said, well, I have to wear this blood for a couple more hours, but after you go to bed and I'm done working, I'll do a video of me getting the blood washed off so you know it's fake. And that's what I did. I shot the video and forwarded it to Jen. And in the morning, she was able to show it to him and tell him, see, Daddy wasn't really hurt. Have they ever been around you when you've been approached by fans who've seen you in Supernatural? Or before that, when you were a series regular on Gilmore Girls? Oh, sure. Pre-COVID days, if we'd be out at a restaurant or at an airport, sometimes people would come up and take a picture. And my kids would be like, is that your friend? And I'd say, well, that's my new friend. And fortunately, the people that know my work are usually fans of it. They'll come up and say things like, hey, I really like that movie. My buddy and I watched it the other day. Or some guys might say, hey, I hate to admit this, but I watch Gilmore Girls. And I'll say, that's all right, man. It's a good show. Tom Hanks often talks about his massive collection of typewriters. I understand you have your own obsession. Watches. I think obsession is putting it mildly. Is there a more intense word than obsession? Yes, I am fascinated by watches and timekeeping and the mechanical, magical aspects of the idea of somebody sitting down and creating something that can be wound and keep time. And I love them for what that means. Some of the best gifts that I've ever received have been watches. And when I try to find a good gift for somebody for something, for some type of event in their life, I try to make it a watch. But yes, I'm head over heels obsessed with horology. Do you own an Apple Watch? Yes, but I do tend more towards the analog watch. It just feels like I can hold a piece of history on my wrist And it's almost like a little charm or something that kind of resets you. You can look down and you have that moment just to yourself. You're not looking around at this crazy world. You're not looking at your phone. You're not looking at your iPad or your computer or your TV. It's the moment with yourself to look down and check in. And hopefully appreciate to some degree the level of technical mastery that was required to put that little thing together. And that's one of the many reasons why I'm into watches. Your home certainly has a distinctively Texas flavor, and I'm not just talking about architecture. I think that goes back to the watch thing. I do have a great appreciation for history and tradition, and I would much rather have an artwork from 80 years ago than artwork from 8 months ago. So we do have some great Texas paraphernalia on display. And we have some replica letters from the Alamo, original old Texas maps, and old Texas Railroad bills of sale, original currency from the late 1800s and whatnot. That's what I like to surround myself with. It gives me a calm feeling. It reminds me to be reverent of what came before me. We have the limestone exteriors, and we've got a big old steel ball out in the front yard that I've been practicing my roping on. But yeah, I'm a big fan of classic Western art and memorabilia. We have some Edward Curtis photographs. Like I say, it gives me a great calm, peaceful feeling when I get home from a hectic day. A shelter from the storm in more ways than one these days, right? That's true. We live just a 20-minute drive from downtown Austin, and we've got a couple of acres. We have chickens, bunnies, bees, dogs, and we have a garden. So it feels like we live on our own little ranch. But we can hop in the car and be downtown for dinner in 20 minutes. Of course, we haven't been able to do that much of lately, but it's been great to have this place during the quarantine. We can just be a family on our own property. Getting back to Walker, just how intense has your work schedule been as you approached your premiere date? Very intense. We were originally supposed to finish Supernatural the first week of April and then start Walker 2 weeks later. And so I knew my lines for the pilot in March. And then March 13th, Friday the 13th, we got sent home from Vancouver because we had this looming pandemic and no one knew what things were going to look like. And so there's been such a buildup. I feel like I've been on a bull sitting behind the gate going, let me out, let me out, let me out. Let's get to work. Let me do my thing. There's been such anticipation and I've been so eager to start. You put a lot of demands on yourself. You put a lot of expectations on yourself, and you just want to get out there and do it. I love developing a show, developing a story, but I've been ready to film the pilot for 8 months before we finally started shooting it. But I have to admit I'm having a great time. Just think, I'm playing a character who needs to be on horseback, roping and galloping, and then the next day I'm doing a fight scene. So you get done with the day of horseback riding, and then you have to go to stunt rehearsal and go through those motions. We have to start early because the sun comes up at 6:30 or 7, and we need to be ready to shoot then because the sun's going to go down around 5:30. We have 12 hours of work we have to fit into 10. So it's sort of an all-hands-on-deck situation, but it's wonderful. I feel like it's an embarrassment of riches. My cup runneth over, and I'm so excited to do all this. I feel like I need 36-hour days to get it done sometimes, and then I go home, and I'm a husband and a father. Home Sweet Stockyards. Hotel Drover is the crown jewel in a host of new developments to Mule Alley in Fort Worth's most beloved and historic area. By Hunter Hawk. Livestock business, tourism, live entertainment, and nightlife have made Fort Worth's historic stockyards a premier Western destination for generations. The area that began in earnest as a crucial livestock shipping point during the late 1800s has evolved into a bustling, walkable destination, still functional for the industry at large, but now the number one source of endless fun and hospitality for Cowtown's visitors. The history is rich, and it's honored in every corner of the stockyards, from the musical lore of large and legendary Billy Bob's Texas, to the lasting beauty of the Grand Livestock Exchange Building, with interest points and must-visit entities all along the way. So, any new development there has to be done with sensitivity and with respect to what came before. The newest round of additions and developments to the stockyards, one of the most significant the area's ever seen, indeed arose from concerns for both the past and the future. Most of the last decade had been devoted to the development overseen by Craig Cavalier, Executive Vice President of Majestic Realty Company and Stockyards Heritage Development Company. Cavalier, a fourth-generation Texan, was brought in by longtime Stockyards investor Holt Hickman before Hickman's 2014 passing to breathe new life into a part of the neighborhood that had housed iconic horse and mule barns for more than 100 years. Hickman was transferring responsibility to his son and daughter, and we were going through second-generation transitions with the different owners in the stockyards, Cavalier says. Throughout the stockyards, the second generation of family was taking things over, so there was an opportunity to come in and try to do some consolidation and real master planning around what could be the next chapter. We really wanted it to respect not just the stockyards, but the American West and the storytelling of the early Texan settlers and the grit and determination that they had in setting up the frontier. And then, of course, there were the great cattle drives in the mid to late 1800s, the Chisholm Trail, and the role that the stockyards played in the evolution of the cattle industry. The result of the involvement of Cavalier and the creation of the Stockyards Heritage Development Company has started to see light of day over the last several months after years of planning and development. New eateries such as the Biscuit Bar and Chef Marcus Pesley's Provender Hall, and iconic storefronts from the likes of Lucchese, Wrangler, and King Ranch Saddle Shop are now in place. The crown jewel of the development, expected to open to the public in February, is Hotel Drover, a decidedly Western 200-room luxury lodge designed to be the central point of all activity in the Stockyards' new iteration of Mule Alley. Originally planned for a 2020 open, Hotel Drover's developers found they needed a little more time for build-out during the first stages of the worldwide pandemic. It was not a bad idea to push it back a little for us anyway, because it just takes time to build one of these four-star hotels, Cavalier says. These things have got a lot of exterior landscaping and fire pits and pools and outdoor areas. It just takes time to get done. So February would be just right for us on that one. Honestly, other than the Hotel Emma and a handful of others around the state, there's nothing that will rival the unique experience of Hotel Drover. A hard hat tour toward the end of the summer confirmed that Cavalier isn't exaggerating. The rustic, homey front of the complex seems designed to make visitors feel welcome, but they'll be taken aback when they step inside to see the grand bar and lobby area with its warm stone and wood textures. The design scheme extends to the rooms, suites, an eatery, 97 West Kitchen and Bar, retail spaces including the Lucchese Custom Boot Shop, and more than 12,000 square feet of available meeting space for groups and conferences. The name of the hotel itself is inspired by the drovers whose last stop on their cattle drives was often Fort Worth. The hotel's marketing materials cite the attention to history well. Returning to the stockyards after months on the open plains brought familiarity, comfort, and the feeling of coming home. The Caro Legacies and Diverse Descendants. The North American cowboy doesn't encompass just one custom or image, but includes a whole range of traditions and cultures. That's the photogenic point of a new exhibition of roughly 50 photographs at Booth Western Art Museum. Showcasing the many variations on the cowboy theme, it traces the legacy of the first cowboys through many expressions of the Western tradition, highlighting Mexican charros, Indian relay races, and rodeos, Hawaiian pañolas, as well as black rodeos and African-American cowboys. The history of the North American cowboy can be traced back to the early Spanish horsemen, the vaqueros, who brought their craft and traditions to the Americas in 1867, says Booth Curator of Photography Dr. Samuel Drace III. Since then, cowboy culture can be found from the east to the west coast of the United States, and even in Hawaii. This exhibition is a celebration of those diverse descendants, spanning rodeos to ranching and those in between. Museum Executive Director Seth Hopkins knew of a number of talented photographers who were delving into the cowboy lifestyle, the cowboy mystique, the cowboy way. All different types of people who wound up being cowboys and who might have different lingo and different dress, but were essentially all doing the same job, but doing it differently. The idea for an exhibition that would capture those varied manifestations through the lenses of multiple photographers became Vaquero Legacies and Diverse Descendants. The show features a great cross-section of America, Hopkins says, and brings together color and black and white images from contemporary photographers such as Richard Ducree, Jade Dessard, Colin Erie, Antonio Gomez, Anouk Kranz, Nadine Levin, Barbara Van Cleve, Travis Gillett, Ivan McClellan, Julia Coombs, Rosianna Sales, Christopher Pugmire, with filmmaker Doug Hancock, and others. Hopkins, and especially drawn to the work of Kranz. She's from France and comes to it a real outsider with the romantic ideas of a European thinking of the cowboy ideal. Then, after being exposed to the real thing, she found that it wasn't what she thought it was. The authentic blue-collar American, patriotic with all these ideals that a cynical city person in Europe thought was a cliché, is real, or more real than anything that could ever have been in her mind. For Drace, it's difficult to pick a favorite. The photographers in the exhibition each document the breadth of cowboy culture in their own special way. To me, what is striking about the artists, and indeed the exhibition, is their unique styles and subjects. Anouk Kranz transforms the western sky into a huge expanse through the use of stark contrast. Colin Erie documents the Compton Cowboys, blending aspects of documentary and editorial photography to celebrate this group of African Americans as they work to educate and inspire future generations. Richard Ducree uses color and black and white photography to highlight the blend of African, African American, and Western traditions among riders in black rodeos. There's also the work of Antonio Gomez, a photography professor at College of Southern Nevada, whose crisp black and whites of the charrea is a Mexican version of rodeo. Document participants and spectators, charros, traditional clothing, and the vibrant atmosphere of the events. The ways in which long-lived traditions are passed on from generation to generation is central to Gomez's series, Dre says. His work shows the struggle of many Mexican immigrants who make it their mission to pass on equestrian precision and human nobility to the next generation. When you see all of the diverse images together in one exhibition, Drace says, a more holistic picture of the American cowboy begins to emerge. Here are some interesting articles from the January 2021 issue of True West magazine. What was the cost of room and board at a Harvey house? In about 1900, a breakfast consisting of cereal, fruit, eggs atop a steak, hash browns, 6 large hot cakes, maple syrup and butter, coffee, topped off with apple pie, would cost you 50 cents. Dinner went for a quarter more and included a gourmet dish or wild game. Men were required to wear a jacket in the dining room. In 1909, rooms went from $3 to $5. In 1910, the average annual salary for Americans was $700. Did early American Indians believe in God? All tribes had religion, most of them very specific to their group and its historical and cultural experiences. Most were polytheistic. They had several gods. When whites came to this continent, priests and others tried to convert the Indians to Christianity, often at the point of a gun. This caused resentment that still lasts today. As time went on, some American Indians adopted Christianity on their own. Others adapted it, incorporating the faith into their traditional beliefs. In the earliest times, say the 17th to mid-19th centuries, Indians passed on their culture and religion orally, since most lacked written languages. How did robbers find out about which stagecoach was carrying a payroll? Well, sometimes it was just hit or miss. Small-time bandits didn't plan well and took their chances. If the stagecoach they were planning to rob didn't have a shotgun messenger on board, it's a good bet it wasn't carrying a shipment. One might have to settle for a few dollars from the passengers. The smart ones tried to find out ahead of time about payrolls and shipments. This wasn't a stage robbery, but there was substantial planning for the payroll holdup at Castle Gate, Utah, on April 21, 1897. Butch Cassidy hung around town and casually made conversation with the local mine workers. He was able to get a pretty good idea when the next payroll would arrive. Did Old West gunfighters really tie down their holsters? Most experts say a tie-down Buscadero rig was a 20th century Hollywood creation. It looked cool, and the fast draw guys could have shootouts. Photos indicate there were some exceptions, but that's just what they were. Traditionally, the most common holster in the Old West was the Mexican loop, where the holster flap goes over the top of the belt and is loose. It doesn't need a tie-down. Truth is, the pistol waist high or slightly below enables a shooter to get the gun in action faster than a low-slung Buscadero. Besides, these Hollywood-style shootouts, a staple in the movies, are very rare in the real West. Did cowboys use gloves in their work? Leather gloves were an essential part of a cowboy's attire. These protected the hands from rope burns, blisters, brush, and hot branding irons. He also wore leather cuffs. These protected his wrists from rope burns and kept his lower shirt sleeves from wear and tear.
Hello, this is Michael. I'm going to be reading some articles from the archives of True West magazine. A Questionable Fight in San Francisco by Harold L. Edwards. Published in True West magazine, July 1998. During the late evening of December 2, 1896, heavyweight boxers Bob Fitzsimmons and Tom Sharkey fought a scheduled bout in San Francisco, California. Both men were championship contenders, and much was at stake for each of them. The bout was energetically fought. However, in the eighth round, the referee stopped the contest by declaring Sharkey the winner, claiming that Fitzsimmons had struck his opponent with a foul low blow. There were immediate cries from the press and the spectators that the fight had been rigged and the outcome was prearranged for Fitzsimmons to lose. That, in fact, Fitzsimmons had not fouled his opponent. While public feelings over the fight were intense at the time, the controversy surrounding the fight would have lessened with the passage of time had the referee of the bout not been Wyatt Earp, famous frontier-era peace officer and local celebrity. As a result, the Fitzsimmons-Sharkey fight controversy has been active to this day, more as a part of the Wyatt Earp legend than as an occurrence in the history of American boxing. During the 1890s, athletic contests were popular entertainment for Americans, especially in the metropolitan areas, where gate money and wagers were plentiful. Although other sporting events were well attended, boxing was especially attractive, and athletic clubs regularly sponsored them. Although the fistic sport was billed as boxing, more often the bouts were professional prize fights, conducted under simple rules when compared with modern standards. Often the purse was winner-take-all, and big money was to be gained by side bets. Since the referees often had the sole power of declaring the winners of the contests, it was essential for fairness that they have reputations for honesty and credibility, which sometimes wasn't the case. The Bob Fitzsimmons-Tom Sharkey fight took place in the Mechanics Pavilion. Both contestants were popular and considered world-class boxers. Although Fitzsimmons was better known than his opponent, Sharkey was almost regarded as the hometown boy. Fitzsimmons was 10 years older than Sharkey, and he had been put to the test many times. He was a veteran boxer who, over a long career, had whipped some notable opponents. Born in Cornwall, England, in 1862, Fitzsimmons had migrated to New Zealand, where he became a blacksmith and later a professional fighter. San Franciscans eagerly awaited the arrival of Ruby Robert, so-called because of his ruddy complexion. Tom Sharkey was born in Dimdulk, Ireland in 1872. It isn't certain when he arrived in the United States, but he eventually entered American service as a seaman in the United States Navy. He boxed his way to a Navy championship before putting his talents as a boxer to professional use. Sharkey had also confronted some big names in the sport. He stayed 8 rounds with Joe Chonsky, a popular contender from San Francisco. He had also boxed San Francisco's heavyweight champion, James Corbett, known as Gentleman Jim, to a 4-round draw. Even though the young Sharkey had earned a slot in the top ranks, his pending bout with Fitzsimmons was most important if he was to challenge the champion. All of the arrangements surrounding the fight, except for the selection of the referee, were made weeks in advance. San Francisco newspapers heralded the approaching event on their prime pages. There were large headlines, long columns, and abundant illustrations advising sports fans of the contestants' ring prowess, physical attributes, personal and professional histories. They quoted the combatants' statements about their opponents and the coming fight. The ballyhoo from the fighters' managers and the fight promoters were reported in detail, and the newspapers only speculated on the fight's outcome. The match was promoted relentlessly. By the day the contest was to take place, the public was in a state of high excitement, and the bout was a guaranteed sellout. However, as the time for the fight drew near, the referee for the match still had not been selected. During negotiations, neither side would agree to the suggestions of the other. The fight contract stipulated that if the contestants could not agree on who should be the referee, the National Athletic Club, under whose auspices the fight was sponsored, would make the selection. The selection was stalled when one of the fight promoters, Andrew Long Green Lawrence, recommended Wyatt Earp for the job. According to the San Francisco Morning Call, Earp was being employed by Lawrence as a bodyguard, which could raise the question of a conflict of interest. National Athletic Club manager J.D. Gibbs, however, accepted Lawrence's suggestion and appointed Earp as referee. Gibbs said he had met Earp only once, but felt his reputation as a clear-headed, cool person of impeccable standards would be fair to both fighters. Further, Gibbs said that Earp had refereed about 30 fights and had the experience necessary for the position. The club's only interest was to give Fitzsimmons and Sharkey an equal chance in the ring, and for that reason, the club wanted a just and able referee for the contest. In 1896, Wyatt Earp was an aging but active member of the sporting world. He was well known in California, but his reputation was controversial. He was believed by some to have been a dedicated lawman during the turbulent frontier era, who brought honest law and order to the wild Kansas trail towns and to Tombstone, Arizona. His supporters felt he was a man of high personal ethics, integrity, and honesty, and conducted himself by those standards throughout his entire adult life. Others saw him quite differently. They believed he was a frontier fringe character who was a sometimes corrupt peace officer, unethical gambler, pimp, confidence man, and gunfighter whose personal standards were, at best, questionable. While it was apparent to his detractors that he didn't pursue these perceived activities in his later life, they still felt he was a fringe character of the sporting world and not to be trusted. However, he was appointed referee and the bout went ahead as scheduled. At 10:05 p.m., Fitzsimmons and his entourage wound their way through the throngs of spectators who gathered in the aisles. He was cheered enthusiastically when he climbed into the ring. The fighter nodded to some nearby acquaintances and sat on a stool in his corner. He was attended by his manager, Martin Julian, and Daniel Hickey and Jack Steinzer. Fitzsimmons appeared calm, confident, and cheerful. A few minutes later, Sharkey and his group made their way down the aisle and into the ring. The popular contender received a greater ovation from the crowd than did Fitzsimmons, and it was apparent that he was the favorite. Although appearing somewhat nervous, Sharkey acknowledged the cheers and encouragement of his supporters. He was attended by his manager, Daniel Lynch, who was aided by Daniel Needham, George Allen, and Billy Smith. After Sharkey had been seated for a moment, Fitzsimmons walked across the ring to Sharkey's corner. He introduced himself to Sharkey and said he hoped the best man would win. He and Sharkey shook hands, and Fitzsimmons returned to his corner. Announcer Billy Jordan, who was already in the ring, went to the ropes and called loudly for Wyatt Earp. Adding to the pre-fight tension, Jordan called for Earp several more times before the referee entered the ring. Jordan announced that Wyatt Earp had been selected as referee. The news was met with an equal chorus of cheers and hisses. Jordan announced that Martin Julian had refused to accept the referee due to some talk of Earp being crooked. At this announcement, Fitzsimmons smiled as his spectators loudly cheered and hissed. After a brief conference with club officials, Julian walked to the ropes and announced to the crowd that Sharkey's manager, the club officials, and he had met and tried to select a referee. According to Julian, he suggested half of a dozen men, among them Hiram Cook, a noted legitimate referee. Lynch had objected to all of them, and finally, the club selected Earp. This statement was met with more cheers and hisses. The crowd seemed to be enjoying the drama. Julian told the crowd that when he and Fitzsimmons heard Wyatt Earp had been selected as referee, the appointment was initially agreeable. Since then, several sporting men from San Francisco had come to them and said that the referee was crooked, that the outcome of the fight was predetermined. Sharkey's manager then addressed the crowd. He reported that he and Fitzsimmons' representative met in conjunction with the officers of the club and had come to an agreement. He announced that Sharkey had lived up to every article he agreed to. He was willing and ready to fight with the referee selected by the club. The crowd roared its approval. Announcer Jordan then advised the spectators that Fitzsimmons' manager was willing to select any referee in the house. The crowd answered the challenge by shouting, "Wyatt Earp," While excited and tense, the spectators were still good-natured, jovial, and enjoying the show. One of them shouted an inside joke that made the crowd laugh. "Get Judge Campbell!" At this point, Fitzsimmons stood and raised his hand for attention. When the crowd quieted, he said he had compromised in all of his fights and he would do the same in that one. After the cheers from spectators subsided, Fitzsimmons said that Sharkey would have to do one thing, and that was to take the bandages off of his hands. Fitzsimmons had none on his. The spectators cheered and shouted, "Take them off, Sharkey!" Billy Jordan then announced that Fitzsimmons accepted Earp as referee. Sometime during all of this, San Francisco police captain Charles Whitman noticed a bulge under Wyatt Earp's coat. He knew it was a concealed weapon. Whitman entered the ring and ordered the referee to surrender the pistol, which Earp handed to him without resistance. The boxing gloves were handed into the ring by an official, and Fitzsimmons' gloves were laced onto his hands while Sharkey removed the bandages from his hands. Referee Earp took his coat off. Sharkey gargled some water, and Fitzsimmons rubbed the soles of his shoes in the resin box as Billy Jordan announced, "This will be a 10-round contest, and at the end of 10 rounds, the man having the best of the contest will be awarded the certified check for $10,000, which is now in the referee's hands." Earp handed the announcer the check, who waved it over his head for the crowd to see. Jordan returned the check to Earp and continued, "The men have agreed in a clinch to break away fair and square and do no fighting." The ring was cleared for action. Billy Jordan then announced Sharkey as the pride of the American Navy and the champion of the Pacific Coast. Sharkey was roundly cheered. Jordan followed by Fitzsimmons as the champion of the world. Fitzsimmons was cheered, although not as lustily as Sharkey had been. The contestants returned to their corners, and at 10:46 p.m., the bell started to sound the first round. For 7 rounds, the classical boxer, Bob Fitzsimmons, outclassed and outboxed Sharkey. Both men threw punches. Some landed lightly, others were blocked or missed. Some of them connected with jarring effect. The battlers clinched often. Near the end of the first round, Fitzsimmons knocked Sharkey to the canvas with either a right-hand punch to the arm or to the jaw. The call reported it was to the jaw. The Chronicle said it was to the arm. Sharkey got quickly to his feet as the bell rang, ending the round. Rounds 3 and 4 were hard-fought with no knockdown punches. During round 4, Sharkey appeared more aggressive and stronger than he had in previous rounds. He knocked Ruby Robert down with a hard punch to the jaw. Fitzsimmons regained his feet immediately and carried the fight to Sharkey, landing blows with both hands, drawing blood from over Sharkey's eye. The 5th round wasn't noteworthy, except that Sharkey grabbed Fitzsimmons by the leg and lifted him off of the floor. He let Fitzsimmons drop, and the fighters went on throwing punches. The next 2 rounds evolved with no serious blows landed by either man. By the end of the 7th round, both men appeared to be tiring. The call reported that Sharkey was very slow to come up at the beginning of the 8th round. According to the article, Fitzsimmons was very chipper and dancing around. The Chronicle, however, stated that Sharkey came up very fresh, and the battle was resumed as vigorously as at the early stages of the game and exactly on the same lines. Suddenly, Fitzsimmons struck Sharkey 2 blows, which knocked the sailor to the mat. Fitzsimmons had delivered a hard blow to Sharkey's body and then an uppercut to the chin. Sharkey tried to get to his feet, but rolled over, clutching his groin. Immediately, referee Earp declared Sharkey the winner of the fight as a result of a foul low blow delivered by Fitzsimmons. Most of the reporters and spectators saw Fitzsimmons's punch to Sharkey's chin, but not many saw the punch to the body. It had all happened so suddenly that the spectators were puzzled and bewildered by the referee's decision. When the crowd recovered from its shock, individuals began shouting that the fight was fixed and that Fitzsimmons had been robbed. Instantly, Sharkey was no longer the favorite. While Sharkey was assisted to his corner by his seconds, a number of police officers entered the ring. The crowd became unruly, almost to the point of becoming a mob. Sharkey was paid the check, and the referee left the ring and the pavilion quickly and quietly. Eventually, the spectators left the arena without further trouble, but the fight wasn't ended. It was still to be fought in the press and the court. As expected, Fitzsimmons claimed to have been robbed. He told newspaper reporters that he had never fought cleaner and had been cheated out of the winner's purse. The press agreed with him, and the public supported him. In the meantime, Sharkey reposed in his hotel room, attended by his physician. He supposedly suffered injury from the low blow. In a statement to the press, Sharkey said, "All I am sorry for is that the foul blow was delivered in that round, because I had Fitzsimmons going and would surely have whipped him in the next round," a sentiment not held by those who viewed the fight. Sharkey continued, "He fouled me frequently, and I thought the referee would give the fight against Fitz before the eighth round," also a view not held by the fight spectators. Wyatt Earp dropped by Sharkey's hotel to see how the battered fighter was doing. Interestingly, he was asked by newspaper reporters how the alleged foul blow was delivered, as apparently no one had seen it. He responded, "When Sharkey ducked to avoid a right-hand cross, Fitzsimmons stooped as low as he could and hooked him with a left in the groin. Tom keeled over, and I immediately gave the fight against Fitzsimmons as I considered it a most palpable foul." Earp further stated that he didn't know Sharkey before the night of the fight, but that he had been introduced to Fitzsimmons some years before by Bat Masterson. Earp went on to say, "I am sure that Masterson lost considerable money on the result, but I cannot help that." Wyatt Earp told the reporters that he had almost disqualified Fitzsimmons in the fight when he gashed Sharkey's eye with a backhanded blow. When he was asked about Sharkey's fouls, such as lifting Fitzsimmons off the ring floor in the fifth round, Earp replied, "Those fouls were unintentional and Sharkey meant nothing by them. I do not notice any unintentional fouls, but of the two men, Fitzsimmons certainly committed the most palpable fouls, and that is why I decided in favor of Sharkey." Earp's supporters accepted his statements, but in general, the press and the public held an opposite view, believing Earp had described a foul blow that never occurred. At the request of Martin Julian, the National Athletic Club asked the Anglo-California Bank to stop payment on Sharkey's certified check. Later that day, Daniel Lynch and Wyatt Earp appeared at the bank with the check for payment. They were advised that the check would not be cashed, pending court action on the matter. The National Athletic Club made a public statement. "We withheld payment of the check because of the expressions of dissatisfaction on the part of many of the audience. Some claimed that the referee was a party to a job to cheat Fitzsimmons, in order that Fitzsimmons and his backers might have every opportunity to institute the legal proceedings they have threatened after the contest. We, as the directors of the National Athletic Club, requested the Anglo-California Bank to withhold payment of the check for the time being. This action applied only to the purse. The bets on the fight were still paid." Martin Julian filed for a court injunction against payment of the purse to Sharkey in the San Francisco County Superior Court on November 3, 1896. The court ordered a temporary injunction against paying the purse pending a hearing on the matter. In the meantime, in preparation for the hearing, the National Athletic Club's manager, J.J. Groom, advised reporters that he was having a team of reputable physicians examine the injured Sharkey, who at the moment was confined to his bed in the Windsor Hotel. It was hoped that their findings would clear the club of any suspicion. The examination was held in Sharkey's hotel room at 4:30 that afternoon. Doctors Joseph Pescia, J.S. Barrett, T.A. Ratanzi, Charles Schilling, Winslow Anderson, and D.D. Lustig were selected to examine Sharkey. They were primarily interested in the extent of his injury and if it had been caused by a low blow. A Dr. Reagan was present during the examination, and he represented Sharkey and his team. He examined Sharkey first. At the conclusion of his examination, he turned to Dr. Lustig and said that there were no doubts about Sharkey's injuries. Dr. Lustig looked Sharkey over and said his injury was not as bad as had been reported. A quarrel developed between the two physicians. According to the December 4, 1896 issue of The Call, Reagan responded, "Yes, that may be, but if you look at his eyes, you will notice that they are affected by the injury." "Oh, nonsense," replied Dr. Lustig. "What on earth do the eyes have to do with this injury?" The other physicians examined Sharkey, and their joint conclusion was announced by Dr. Lustig. The conclusion of the physicians, according to The Call, was that the injury, at the time it happened, was not severe enough to have kept Sharkey from continuing the fight. Whether or not the blow which caused the injury was foul was not reported. The Chronicle reported, "Sharkey was examined by a number of physicians, and the verdict was heartily in his favor." Later in the column, the newspaper hedged on its unequivocal leading statement and reported the physician's findings a bit more in line with that of The Call. In the meantime, Earp made no effort to reclaim the revolver the police had taken from him in the ring, and since he failed to appear at the police station, four officers were detailed to find him. Officer Frank Riley located Earp at a restaurant and informed him that he was wanted at the police station. Earp went with Officer Riley willingly, and on his arrival at the station, Captain Whitman asked him where he had been all day. Earp responded that he had been at the races since that morning. According to the press reports, Earp said, "Since there is so much damn talk in town about my decision, I wanted to get away from it." Captain Whitman informed Earp that he was under arrest for carrying a concealed weapon. Earp was conducted to the city jail, where the charge was booked against him. He posted a $50 bail and was released. San Francisco Police Chief Patrick Crowley informed newspaper reporters that Earp wasn't arrested at the time he was relieved of his weapon, as it would have been very impolite to have arrested him in the presence of 12,000 spectators. He explained that the fight spectators would have believed the police were trying to stop the fight over a very trivial matter. Crowley said he didn't know if Earp had a permit to carry a concealed weapon, but it was extraordinary for him to carry a gun while he was in the ring. Earp eventually paid a $50 fine for the charge. On December 17, 1896, Judge Sanderson held a hearing on the injunction against paying Sharkey the purse. Curiously, even though a number of witnesses testified as to whether or not the fight had been fixed against Fitzsimmons, the case didn't resolve around this issue. The question ultimately was if the fight was illegal in the first place. There was a wide difference between a prize fight and a gloved boxing contest held before a club. A prize fight, in violation of the statutes, meant a fight in which the contestants tried to injure each other for money. Prize fighting was illegal in San Francisco at the time. Club-sanctioned gloved contests were licensed and perfectly legal. Fitzsimmons had testified that he had fought Sharkey for a purse of $10,000 and had disabled his opponent to the extent he couldn't continue the bout. Therefore, he was entitled to the purse. His testimony confirmed that the contest was for a prize and that he had injured Sharkey for money. The court stated that the contest violated the law and that those who had participated in it were guilty of misdemeanors. The court, therefore, had no interest in the contention of who was entitled to the purse. At this point, a motion was made by Sharkey's representatives for the injunction to be dismissed and allow their fighter to be paid. The court ordered in favor of the motion, but not before saying that the police and the Board of Supervisors had winked at the law in permitting the fight to take place, and that the matter could be referred to the grand jury. To the astonishment of many San Franciscans who believed the fight had been fixed, Sharkey was awarded the $10,000 purse. The Call referred to the payment as swag, and the consensus at the time was that Fitzsimmons was cheated. Nat Fleischer, a boxing historian, stated in his 1959 book, A Pictorial History of Boxing, this was a flagrant example of ring robbery, the verdict being rendered by Wyatt Earp, a Western marshal, after Sharkey had been knocked out by a blow which had landed fairly above the belt. Fleischer's words were direct, but they reflected the general opinion of the bout since 1896. Did referee Wyatt Earp honestly believe he saw Fitzsimmons strike Sharkey a foul blow? Did he declare the battered and beaten Sharkey the winner of the fight from an honest conviction? Or was the old lawman the instrument for a group of conspirators? While the circumstances surrounding the fight indicate it was fixed, the answers to these questions have never been offered, leaving the Fitzsimmons-Sharkey bout a most questionable fight in San Francisco.
Thank you for joining us for the Western Magazine Hour. Stories and articles about the American West. Your narrator has been Jack. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.